Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Good evening and welcome to Little Atoms. I'm Padraig Reedy and co-hosting the show this week with me is Neil Denny. Our guest is Matthew Sweet, whose latest book is The West End Front. And I'll hand over to Neil to tell you a little more about Matthew.
Thanks, Padraig. Matthew Sweet is a writer and broadcaster. He presents Night Waves and Free Thinking on BBC Radio 3 and The Philosopher's Arms and the Film Programme on BBC Radio 4. He is the author of Inventing the Victorians and Shepperton Babylon, The Lost Worlds of British Cinema, which he adapted as a film for BBC 4. His TV programmes include Silent Britain, A Brief History of Fun, The Age of Excess, Truly Madly Cheaply and The Rules of Film Noir. And as Padraig mentioned, Matthew's latest book is The West End Front, which we'll be talking about tonight. Matthew, welcome to Little Atoms.
Well, thank you for asking me here.
Slightly intimidating having such a radio professional. In the
tell you what, I'll be completely amateurish.
So tell us first of all, where did the seed of the idea for this book come from?
Well, this was a very long time ago, actually, 1997, when I was sent to Albania by the Independent newspaper in the days when it did things
like
that.
You'd done something wrong.
I hadn't done something wrong, no. I hadn't broken a rule of any kind. That isn't what happened to you in those days. No, I got sent to report on the attempts of King Lekka of the Albanians to get the throne of Albania back. Albania, of course, had not been a monarchy during its communist period when Enver Hoxha was in charge. And I became rather fascinated by him. So I went out there and followed him as he went on the campaign trail trying to get the throne of the country back. There was a referendum going on. And I went with him from town to town in this motorcade. And generally what happened was that he would start making a speech and then people would start firing guns into the air. They were, after the collapse of the pyramid schemes in the late 90s, when a large number of Albanians lost their life savings, they suddenly became the best armed civilian population on earth because they raided the armories in the hope of getting their money back. And so everywhere we went, the crowds would shout, "Where's the money? Where's the money?" And I thought they were talking about this pyramid collapse scheme. But the interpreter said, no, it's an older story than that. They're talking about what Lekka's father did in the war. Lekka's father was a man called King Zog, a name that kind of rattles around in the back of the cultural memory. He's mentioned in George Orwell's Coming Up to Air. He's kind of a faint joke echoing through history. But the story goes that when Zog left Albania, very, very suddenly, as the Italian army marched in, Mussolini had paid for a lot of roads to be built in Albania in the 30s, and the Italian army put them to very good use in 1939-40. And off he went with, it was said, the gold reserves of Albania in his hat boxes, in his suitcases. And he went to the Ritz in London, and they booked into a whole floor of the Ritz and occupied it there. And I thought, well, what were these places? What kind of worlds did they contain? And then for the same article, I interviewed Crown Prince Alexander of Yugoslavia, another kind of exiled East European royal. And he was he had this little office on Park Lane from which he was trying to kind of do something about the Yugoslav crisis of that time. And I went to talk to him. He was born in Claridge's Hotel in Suite 212, which for one night only was declared Yugoslav territory, so that the succession of the Karađorđević dynasty wouldn't be interfered with. So Churchill declared this suite to be, yes, not part of Mayfair, but part of a kind of annex to Belgrade for one night, so that he could be
born there.
You
just mentioned that Alexander was part of a dynasty. Zog himself, he was like King Zog the First.
He was the only one. Well, I mean, you know, there have been others since, but none of them have ever really truly sat on the throne, as it were, in Albania. Not in the kind of the regal sense, anyway. But yes, no, he was Prime Minister, and he sort of promoted himself in quite an extravagant way and declared himself king. He's the only king that the country has ever had, although they were looking for other. They were looking for a candidate for years. There was a famous English cricketer who they were considering offering the throne to. They thought that would be nice.
Let's go back slightly. So the book is about the life that went on in the grand hotels of London during World War II. And we tend to think these as, not that any of us, I think, in this room at least, spend much time in them, but we tend to think of these things as permanent fixtures in the landscape. There's Claridge's, there's the Dorchester, there's the Ritz, there's the Savoy, all these things that just seem to have always been there. But they're quite recent inventions, really, aren't
yes,
they?
Yes, although they like to give the impression, that's part of their charm, part of the mystique that they've tried to generate. If you go into the Ritz, you feel you're in some kind of annex of the Palace of Versailles. But if you actually got a pickaxe and whacked away at the walls, you would find something inside that looked very much more like the Flatiron Building or the Empire State. They're very modern buildings, but they have this sort of atmosphere of timelessness. And the idea is really to cut you off from the outside world. They work a bit like Vegas casinos mm-hmm. work, so that if you go to Claridge's, you can look out over Hyde Park, but you can't really see the traffic on Park Lane. If you go to the Savoy, you can look over the river, but you can't really see the Strand. And you know, this is how they work.
So it was around the end of the 19th century this emerged.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, the culture begins yeah. in the late 19th century, and it's the invention of the Savoy group, really, D'Oyly yeah. Carte, Gilbert and Sullivan. That sort of cultural moment produced it, and in fact, Gilbert and Sullivan would have been much more involved with the Savoy Hotel had not one of them objected to the high cost of carpeting the theatre. Next door. But yes, it kind of begins with the Savoy, and then really kind of the people who could afford to go to such places they kind of coined the culture themselves, because there hadn't really been much of a tradition of going out, eating, dancing, smoking in public for the well-off, for Britain's aristocratic or plutocratic members. That sort of thing just didn't really exist. So it really begins in the hotels. This idea of conducting a social life in public in a place that's not, you know, your friend's stately home, but is an environment which you're paying to be.
Mm-hmm. So working at the Savoy at that time was Cesar Ritz, who, you know, who the eponymous hotel is named after, and also Escoffier, who is, you know, a massive man. These are two huge names in the hotel and catering yeah. industry. And there's this amazing fact that both of them were booted out of the Savoy for
yes,
a massive
they were.
Fraud.
Now, this was hushed up for years and years. This only emerged relatively recently. They were scamming the place. So they were kind of diddling the management out of vast quantities of cigars and eggs, all sorts of stuff. And in order for the scandal not to come out, the Savoy management paid them off, and they quietly went off to set up, you know, more grand hotels over the world and in London, one on the Haymarket that's since been demolished, and the Ritz itself. So they did. They were the authors of that. And those men still have a profound effect upon how we conduct ourselves when we go out for dinner, or how the people in the kitchen conduct themselves. I mean, Escoffier's brigade system, which was modelled on the military model, is still employed in any kind of big catering establishment. The way that the work is divided up, the very hierarchical nature of the kitchen, with everybody kind of you know, shouting out the word chef as if they were in, you know, I said it's a brigade, you know, you feel, I think, and still feel that this is not, you know, it's not a democratic place, the hotel kitchen. It preserves those hierarchies that were there at its foundation.
So Ritz and Escoffier would have been, of course, two examples of kind of that would be, have been brought in from Europe, and they'd be the most famous. But of course, we kind of have our stereotype that we have now of the Italian waiter comes from the Grand Hotel as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, people didn't want to be served by British people. I mean, that would have been unthinkable. You know, they weren't perceived to have the manners or the ability to do the cooking either. All of these things were perceived very much as foreign imports of one sort or another, because this culture didn't exist in Britain. It had to be bought in from outside. So that actually, I think, if you were a well-off diner in the 20s, you would have been faintly upset to have somebody British serving you in the Savoy restaurant, and not an Italian, and not an Italian, you know, with very kind of well-developed, elaborate, smooth manners. And these people were, you know, they were figures in their own right. You know, they were written about in the gossip columns. Their opinions were sought on various things. The chefs are kind of in our minds now. We know kind of the celebrity chefs, but in this period, the maitre d's were also substantial figures. They're on quite good money. They all had quite good deals with the management so that they got a cut. You know, every time a cup of coffee was served, a proportion of the profit went to the maitre d'. And they were celebrated figures. They ended up being portrayed in novels, that kind of thing. Arnold Bennett's Imperial Palace. If you dig that off a dusty bookshelf, you'll find that the staff there are all people who are based on real models. And that was why, during the war, when many of the Italians found themselves suffering under Regulation 18B, which was brought in the moment that Italy came into the war, all of these staff were declared enemy aliens. And that came not only as a kind of a shock and a trauma for them, but also the customers couldn't believe that these figures who they trusted and adored really over the previous decades were somehow now enemies of the state. And although the hotel managements didn't protect these people very well and in many cases behaved quite abominably, groups of customers got together to try and advocate the Englishness of some of these Italians, to demonstrate that they couldn't possibly have fascist sympathies, so that you get letters written by eminent industrialists saying things like, well, Mr. Santorelli was terribly English because he once consulted me about the breeding of Tamworth pigs. I only mentioned this, he says, to show how English his outlook was.
He mentioned that Loretta Santorelli, who you alluded to, was the greatest kind of restaurant manager and probably, as you mentioned in the book, one of the most powerful men in the London hotel scene at the time. But yes, he, like many others, ends up in camps.
Yeah.
In a camp.
Yes. We've sort of forgotten this moment, haven't we? This is not a moment that we celebrate when we go out to buy yet another reissue of We'll Meet Again, is it? It's something that slightly kicks against our cosy collective sense that we all pulled together during the war. But yes, many of these people, Italian by birth, but most with British citizenship, many with British citizenship, Santorelli, many naturalised. Santorelli was a naturalised British citizen. Suddenly found themselves the objects of intense suspicion. People were encouraged to inform against them. MI5 opened files on them. And they were marched out of grill rooms and out of restaurants, onto trains. Many of them were sent up to Liverpool, to Waltham Prison there. And I spoke to a couple of people who had who could tell me about what the experience of that was like. And they talked about being put in these cells in Waltham Prison that hadn't been used for 20 years, when they were used for keeping suffragettes force-fed in these cells at Waltham Prison. And no one had been in there since. So what they had to do on the day that they arrived was clear all the dead pigeons and the guano out of these cells. And we're talking about, I mean, the two men I talked to were teenagers at the time that this happened to them. They were both scared, and they were both not encouraged by the fact that along with them in the internment process were all the members of Oswald Mosley's British Union of Fascists, which, these two boys were scared of these people and actually required protection from them on several occasions. So they were sitting there night after night in these cells watching Liverpool being bombed through the bars. And every night they would be given this horrible cup of cocoa, and they would let the fat deliquesce and set on the top of the cocoa, and then make a candle out of it so they could read into the night. And then they were all transported south to internment camps across Britain, one of which was in the winter quarters of the Cyril Mills Circus near Ascot. So all of these men put inside the elephant houses, inside bell tents that were put up there, put behind barbed wire, and where the lions were kept during the out-of-season months, they had to kind of live a fairly miserable existence.
And just as an aside, now you've mentioned it, that circus comes up again later in the book. It has another function.
Yeah, the Bertram Mills Circus, rather. I said Cyril Mills. Cyril Mills was the son of the family. Cyril Mills was also a member of the Secret Services. And there was a plan in place that was given the codename Mills's Circus. And the circus vans were used to transport German double agents and prisoners around secretly. And the plan was if the Germans invaded, all of the double agents in the employ of the British secret state would be loaded up into circus vans and sent out to hotels in Wales. Betsy Coed, I think they were all scheduled to end up at. But yeah, Cyril Mills, son of the circus family, was quite an important figure within MI5 during the wartime period. You know, an interrogator, a handler of double agents.
It did strike me. I mean, it's a complete aside that in Le Carré, they call it the circus.
There's a bowl in the circus, as Alec Guinness.
I wonder if that's keeps saying. Sort of
yes,
link.
I bet that is a reference to that. Yes, I bet it is.
Before we move on from the politics of the time. We can't really ever move on from the politics of the time. There was, of course, fascism would not have been the only perceived threat to the Grand Hotels in the age. There is a wonderful episode in the book describing a communist march towards which hotels?
The Savoy. An invasion. Not just a march, yes.
Tell us a little bit about what
Well,
happened there.
The Savoy became the arena for this because a group of communist campaigners in the East End of London had been arguing for years, in fact, for the building of deep shelters in the East End, because everybody knew that when war came, there would be aerial bombardment. They'd seen this happening in the Spanish Civil War, and they had some ideas, suggestions to present to the government about the provision of deep shelters in the East End to protect that that very dense population there. They knew that the docks would be a target. But the government declined to do this, and in the end went with the Anderson shelter. The Anderson shelter, not a communitarian device, something that you sink into your back garden, a kind of an air raid shelter for the nuclear family, really. And it was said, JBS Haldane, who was a prominent scientist of the period and at the head of this campaign, he said that he overheard some gentleman who was a Franco sympathiser saying in a London club in the late 30s, well, we can't build deep shelters in the East End because if there's a revolution, the RAF won't be able to bomb them. So imagining a communist revolution in Britain, not totally impossible, it has to be said. So shelters like this were never built. And we have this image in our head of EastEnders all huddled in the tube system. This is, again, it's part of this this group of stories with which we reassure ourselves about our good behaviour as a society during the war. Well, without the Savoy invasion, I'm not sure whether they would ever have been opened quite so quickly. What happened was that a group of men and women from the East End went down to the Savoy during the first week of the Blitz, while the bombs were coming down, and demanded to be let into the shelter. Now, you had to let any visitor who turned up on your doorstep into the shelter during an air raid, but it was clear that this wasn't happening.
But we should just explain that the Savoy was a proper steel structure with a basement.
Well,
shelter.
It wasn't quite as strong as the management were saying it was. The Dorchester was the sturdiest building, but the Savoy, like all the hotels in the period, ballyhooed the idea that you were reasonably safe in its shelters. And they managed to get stories circulating in the press about how wonderful their shelters were. Silk partitions between the camp beds, nurses going around the room to see if you were all right, snore warden going down the aisles to check if your neighbours were disturbing you by snoring too loudly in the night. So down they went, this group of East End communists from Stepney, into the air raid shelter. I did manage to speak to one man who was there on the night, an amazing man called Max Levitas, who was a communist councillor after the war in Stepney, and who, if you know the Idea Store in Whitechapel, he's there most mornings. Everybody kind of not quite salutes as he comes in, but he's a real local hero. So if you ever wanted to talk to him, you can always find him down at the Idea Store. But he, was one of the leaders of that group. And down they went into the shelter and said that they wanted bread and butter, but only at Lion's Corner House prices. And actually, kind of out of pure embarrassment, they were allowed to spend the night down there. There was a furious reaction to this in the cabinet. Churchill fumed about this, and it was seen as being kind of the thin end of a wedge, I think. And pretty soon after that, the London Underground was opened. The Elgin Marbles had been down there for a few weeks already, but once the Savoy protest had happened, then people were allowed to shelter in the tunnels from the bombs.
You're listening to Little Atoms today with me, Neil Denny, and Padraig Reedy, and we're talking to Matthew Sweet about his book, The West End Front. So, Matthew, we've talked about, there's a lot in the book about the big famous hotels, the Ritz, the Dorchester and the Savoy, as we've all mentioned, and we've talked about some of those in the first half. But you also look at another side of London hotels, which is a more sort of dowdy, Patrick Hamilton-esque London, and some of the characters and the stories of the sort of denizens of those hotels, and I'd like to look at a few of those. And perhaps, first of all, you could tell us about Sir Curtis Lampson and who he was.
Oh, yeah, Sir Curtis Lampson was a baronet, but more importantly, he was a very... I'm going to say accomplished con man. Actually, he wasn't that accomplished, because the reason why it was possible to find out so much about him is because his schemes always seemed to go wrong. He was an explorer, and he claimed to have gone to all kinds of places. But mainly he was somebody who used his title to try and kind of put a little scam or two. He had a game selling cut-price cigarettes that the tax wasn't quite paid on. He liked to ride on trains without buying a ticket. But during the war, he found that his title was something that people found absolutely plausible. And he tried to get into another scam of selling commissions, which didn't really exist. So he would go to the Charing Cross Hotel, this was his haunt, and he would meet a young man there who was desperate to get into one of the less bullet-ridden parts of the army, and spin him a story that somebody he knew in the War Office, a Viscount, had got a female employee pregnant and needed some money quick, and if he handed over an envelope full of used wonces, then something could be done, and he might find himself in possession of a higher rank than had he gone in as a non-commissioned, one of the non-commissioned ranks. So, and he was the object of a police sting in the end. They found out what he was up to, and they put microphones in the office where he met one of his victims. But yes, he was an amazingly colourful figure, strange and disreputable. Did everything in his career. He was a telephone sanitizer at one point. He also sold some kind of product to farmers that claimed to deal with bovine mastitis. He was an extremely eccentric figure.
It's interesting. I mean, the sort of depictions of the partying that's going on during during the Blitz in the big hotels is almost sort of images of the last hurrah of that sort of living. And
it was a sort of political act, and in a way, this seems to me not to be absolutely reprehensible, because the idea that the upper classes and the rich could preserve the rituals of cocktail hour and dinner was an affront to many, but actually it also did have a kind of propaganda function. If Hitler couldn't wobble somebody's gin and tonic, then perhaps he wouldn't have quite so dramatic effect upon how the trains were running or how shipping was running. So you can see, in a way, how it was thought useful to get this image kind of out there in the culture. But of course it caused terrible resentment too, because it was perceived that these places were kind of five-star bomb shelters. And that had been, ironically, the very image they'd been trying to propagate, but obviously it had a kind of negative side to it too.
But then, of course, the end of the war comes, and the era of Beveridge and stuff comes in, and the end of the sort of Age of Deference, all of that stuff is sort of quite well known. But what's interesting is Sir Curtis Lampson is sort of operating at that, almost at that moment where literally he does walk into places because of his title. His title is his word. He does,
and people believe what he says, or are more inclined to believe what he says because of that. But it's interesting how very soon that was a much less successful strategy. I remember talking to a barman at the Savoy who said just after the war he remembered hearing a customer click his fingers to attract the attention of a waiter, and the waiter turning around and saying, "I'm sorry, sir, have you lost your dog?" And that moment would have been unthinkable before the war. But after the war, that was possible. And yet, in the post-war period, there are still people there at the Duchess rate. And, I talked to hotel employees who remembered in the 70s, kind of people turning up at the Ritz and being a bit nouveau riche and being told that the hotel was full, when actually it was losing money hand over fist and it was half empty. But they just didn't want that sort of person staying on the premises, and yet they would welcome in a baronet who seemed quite capable of doing a moonlight flit.
I want to take us back to the more dowdy side of the London hotel world now, and I think one of the most affecting parts of the book is the story of a woman called Mary Pickwode. So We're sort of quickly running out of time, but let's talk about Mary for the last few minutes.
Mary
of the
Pickford
show.
Is a woman who kind of stands for many during the war. She died of a botched abortion at the Mount Royal Hotel on Oxford Street, and this happened to many women, but hers was a case that I managed to get in contact with the families, all the individuals concerned in it. So I was able to tell something of the story. She died there, you know, really alone, and the operation had been conducted somewhere in Chelsea. She came back to the hotel, and the heartbreaking records account survive of her slow decline and death. And I was able to talk to people in her immediate family and also in the family of the man who was the father of her baby. And it was an extraordinary experience being, you know, having done this research and being able to kind of bring it to these people, many of whom, several of whom were quite kind of prominent figures in British public life, who I am deeply grateful that they were willing to discuss all of this case with me, because they really didn't have to. And it was a very painful business. But I think, in a way, I filled in a few of the blanks for them too. With work like this, it does become an odd kind of process of exchange. You do some archival work. You bring what is essentially very bad news to somebody. And yet, there is a sort of value in it for them, because it allows them to explain something about their own biography that they might not necessarily have been able to do quite fully before. But the repercussions of this relationship, Mary had a relationship with a novelist called Gerard Tickell, who didn't behave particularly well towards her. And you know, the afterlife of the story was fascinating to me too. But she stands for many. You know, there was a case almost exactly like it just a few months after she died. Another woman found dead in the same hotel. It was one of the things that went on there, as well as all the cocktail drinking.
Well, that's not a particularly cheerful point for us to end on, but we're out of time and we've barely scratched the surface. There's some amazing characters in the stories. There are spies. There's a great bit which I really wanted to talk about the bar at the Ritz, and then there's the pink sink.
Oh, the pink sink,
which
yes.
we haven't got a chance to talk about, but I can't recommend this book highly enough. So we've been talking to Matthew Sweet about the West End Front. Matthew, thanks for being on Little Atoms today.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.